transmitter work. I want my granddaughter to grow up and know the true meaning of community, the true meaning of giving back so that others benefit. I am asking for your vote as number one on the local election ballot. My thanks to all of you that have made this journey possible. This has been and continues to be our magic bus. Won't you join me for a ride on the magic bus we call KPFT?
Sign up to vote online today and save KPFT money on printing ballots. We can save our station hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars just by registering to vote online. Please visit elections.pacifica.org, click on the station tab, and scroll to find the official KPFT election page where you can register to vote online as well as hear all the candidates' statements. Thank you.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to Technology Bites.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
I'm Lee.
And he's Grewhouse.
I threw everybody off.
It's a little weird.
I was going to save Dwight for last.
Nah, like he's got to go. He's got to go in the order.
Dwight gets back in the order.
He's accustomed
to. I can
to.
Remember. Yeah, actually, you should have gone.
Was there
before
an
me.
Order that involved
oh,
all
man.
Of these people?
No, you not, go first.
I do.
Go,
no, that's right. I go before you.
I went last.
Are all the mics up? It seems like I can't quite.
I can hear you.
I can hear you. Maybe your headphones.
Are all the
need
headphones
up?
I don't think so.
I've got one unread email and I can't find it. It drives me crazy. Up there.
There we go.
Search by,
and you're not on iOS. It's usually on iOS.
Search by unread.
One.
No, it's Outlook. It's Outlook 2016, so it's the Woo. Mac, the new Mac Outlook. It's all blue.
I love the new
You can
Mac.
Choose the color when you install yes. it.
Dwight.
You went with blue.
How's cat
Dwight's
life?
In the house.
Dwight's
hey,
in the house.
Dwight's in the
oh,
house.
Oh, wow. Dwight holds up.
Whoa.
Dwight Silverman. Scars. Hey, it looks like an emoticon.
I thought he's going to hold up a fist of solidarity, but no, he hands up a wrist of cat scratches.
Either that or a botched
I just saw the two downward ones and then the sly smile scratch. Yeah, it looks like a... Looks like an emoji, a cat emoji.
Scratch fever.
No, when you have a cat in your arms and you're about to put the cat on the bed, and another cat jumps exactly where you're going to put.
That's amore.
That's amore.
That's a something.
First cat problems.
That's blood.
Well, all right, so yeah, Dwight Silverman dropped in on us for our big show before the 20th anniversary party because. I didn't like the fact that you told everybody you weren't going to be
there. Yeah, you're not going to be there. I'm just hearing about this.
I mean, I don't mind that you're not going to be there, but I regret you telling everyone that you weren't going to be there.
What, do you want me to not do it? And people show me, oh, Dwight's not here.
False expectations.
You were our star factor.
Yeah, man. Oh. We were banking on you.
I was hoping to have you sign my boobs, Dwight.
Hey, we got a pin.
He meant Barrett and me.
I doubt it'll wash off before the party.
There you go.
The Three Stooges.
Hey, Mo.
That's Saturday.
It's this Saturday.
20 years, Dwight.
I will be probably sitting next to a fire pit, smoking a cigar and drinking really good whiskey.
Yeah, sounds like a hard life.
Celebrating that you're not with
be
us.
In Kentucky,
in New Mexico, watching the sunset over the New Mexico.
Beautiful.
New Mexico
land of enchantment.
Awesome. So that's where I'll be. That was planned long ago. Sorry. I'm really like upset. That I'm not going to be here.
I think it's awesome that you put in vacation plans 20 years before, before the show even started. That's
a
foresight.
Planner,
I hope you got a good price.
Always thinking way far ahead.
That's right.
He made the bad. Now, there's Pete. Hey, Pete.
Hey.
So, when did you plan this trip? Exactly.
Can we get a spotlight on Dwight, please?
Probably about, I think...
A few days ago.
No, about March or April.
Okay, well...
What day did y'all announce the... When the party was going to be?
About that
January,
day.
February.
we hemmed and hawed on when we were going to do it, and we kept thinking about it.
You weren't going to do it on the usual day of the Geek Gathering.
Right.
But I was hoping that it wouldn't be on this weekend, but...
It looks like we're going to have fantastic weather.
Weather is going to be awesome. Mm-hmm.
We're going to have really great weather. We're going to have a party up on the roof of Cannes. And it looks like low humidity in the 60s.
You might be able to see us. Hoist a glass in our direction.
There you go.
All right.
Face toward Mecca.
Yeah, looking at the hourly weather report, it's like the sun goes down around, I think, like 6:40 or something.
Sounds about right.
And so it should be around 80 degrees or less by 8 o'clock.
30-some-odd percent humidity. Yeah, yeah. Just really low humidity. It's going to be great.
Good.
Yep.
It was roll the dice. We said we were going to do it. Let's do it. We wanted to do it mid-October, hopefully, for the cool weather. And sure enough, if we'd have done it this weekend or last weekend, it would have been hot. And this coming weekend is going to be perfect.
DJ Phil's still going to make it hot. Keep it hot.
Although
are you guys going to be up on the roof? Because there was some discussion about
the roof.
Doing it. You're on the roof.
We're going to be on the roof. So it's outdoors, on the roof.
How are they going to get the beer up to us?
We're going to have a bartender up there. They actually have a little, like, ice house-looking structure where they can serve beer.
Have you been up there?
I parked up there a few times,
Yeah, they've got, like, a little area. They have like a little party area.
Okay, cool.
In fact, if parking's tight, I would say just go on up there, and we're probably going to have a little area cordoned off for parking.
Well, Cone said that he wanted everybody to try to park up there. There's plenty of parking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a section where we're going to do the party, and then there's another section where you can park.
So it'll be geek tailgating is what it's going to be.
Actually, yeah, we should have a little... area reserved for trucks. They could tailgate. We might have a classic car, too.
This evening, Cone posted that if we brought charcoal, that we can grill up there if we wanted, because he's got all the equipment.
Let's do that.
Should we bring meat or just charcoal?
Cats.
Steaks.
All right, that's cool. I'm down with that.
Oh, so my lovely wife requests, while I'm here...
Yes.
Some help with a technology problem.
Oh, we don't do that anymore.
I was not able to solve, maybe because I was rushing out.
We're doing this old school.
So she asks, she has an iPhone 6 like I do. Mm-hmm. She's trying to set her voicemail, because she's going on vacation for her business, to say, I'm not here, don't bug me. But when she goes into the area where you change the greeting on iOS, what happens is you go to the phone... You hit edit, hit greeting, and then when you go here and hit record, nothing happens. You also can't change from default to custom.
Oh, that's interesting.
So what the hell, gentlemen?
You could try doing You guys are with AT&T?
Mm-hmm.
You could try calling your from her phone. Call her phone number and put in if you can remember what your old voicemail password is, and you'll get the regular menu prompts, and you can do all of it from there.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually there's a way to go through to call a number, your own number from your own phone.
I tell you,
there's a number
but you have to remember. You have to remember your password.
All right, I'll tell her.
What I do when I'm setting up my phone for going on a trip is I forward my phone to my Google Voice account so I can at least get text messages, you know, in my email if somebody calls or whatever, and I can if I don't have phone access.
And you
can
have the bonus of hilariously transcribed voicemails.
That's right.
Yes.
Flickton and I are pure Google Voice now. At least I am. You are too, right?
No.
Almost? Oh, you're not? Oh, I'm pure Google Voice.
I kind of did that, but I was annoyed by it, so...
I'm used to the annoyances.
I took my old phone that I had for years, and I ported the number to Google and used a new number. And at first, I was going to keep giving my old number out, which was a Google Voice number now, but I found the Google Voice app on iPhone to be unreliable at best. So eventually I just started giving people the real phone number on my actual
iPhone.
On Android, it's probably, of course, on Android, it's nice. But, yeah, it's very nice and seamless.
All right. Where am I looking for voicemail stuff on my phone?
It should be under – it's like under voice. So you go phone, hit phone first.
Yes.
And then you hit your voicemail thingy.
Oh.
And then
– and then there's a greeting. Edit.
Edit.
And then greet.
Why did they
and
hide
greeting.
It under something that says voicemail?
I know, right? I can't – oh, okay, I can change mine. But I've never changed mine off of default, ever.
Oh, you're on default?
Yeah. But if I hit...
If you hit custom...
Oh, yeah, it's recording. I don't want that. I don't want that.
Cancel. No!
Now you will never get default back.
I don't want that.
Something... Okay, two dumb things. One, has she rebooted the phone ever?
I suggested that to her. She has rebooted ever.
Now, let me say that... Some people do not know what it means to reboot a phone. Some people think that when you press the button and it goes dark, that they've turned it off.
My wife knows how
okay.
to reboot
a phone. I would hope she does, yes. but my wife does not.
Yes.
She thinks that when she presses the button and the screen goes dark,
she even knows what a hard reset is. So.
Okay. That reboots really fast.
Now they, it does.
Look, on, off, on,
is it on, is it off? But the other thing is the iOS up to date?
Yes.
So you don't get the benefits of, like, you know, updating the iOS.
My wife's phone is always up to date.
You do good.
Hmm?
You do good.
You update her phone, do you? Still, after all these years.
On regular.
That's how it works in my house.
I texted her. I said, I have a solution from the geeks, because she asked for help from the geeks. And she said, what? And I said, later. And she said, okay, I'm not on vacation till it's done.
Well, you know, you could tell her to turn on her radio to 90.1 FM KPFT, and we could speak
we
live
could
to her.
Or we could not solve this problem until midnight Saturday after the party.
Yeah, there we go.
Problem solved. Way to go, Lisa, just like we planned.
Thanks,
mm-hmm.
I'll take the communication.
I would say reboot the phone if you haven't done it in a while, and... It just seems like an odd one. I don't know what else you would
I
try.
I suggested that she do a hard reset. I don't.
T-Mobile recommends that you reboot it at least every week.
Well.
Really? Wow. Is that like written down somewhere?
They're the Un-carrier.
Yeah, because I have the T-Mobile app, and it had a little exclamation or a one or whatever. So I went in to check it, and it said, oh, we noticed you haven't rebooted your phone in a while. And I'm pretty sure it said we recommend that you reboot it weekly, like a hard reset weekly.
What other stupid, useless thing does the T-Mobile app do for you?
Too much uptime.
Yeah,
too much uptime.
I don't know. Because, it had been like since I got the phone, I hadn't hard rebooted it. So it had been 3 or 4 weeks or something.
That's right. Uh-huh. So if you have like 99.9% uptime over more than a month, your klaxon goes off.
Right.
It tells you to reboot.
John Laguerre shows up personally and throws your phone against the concrete.
Annoying.
Somebody said go to settings, turn on cellular, turn off Wi-Fi, return to voicemail, record your greeting.
Up, up, down, down, left, right, left, right.
That actually might make some sense. Mm-hmm.
I think something similar might happen if you rebooted, but this might be a way to
all right.
not
take all these things back to her and see what she does. I know you have... That's an awesome phone. He's got.
I kind of like it. Yeah, I broke my other one. I didn't break it.
You were making fun of it at first.
Galaxy S6 Edge Plus.
I really like that phone.
Okay, it needs a bigger name.
So is the Edge the one that has a screen on the edge where you can see things?
Yes, just two edges. Have a regular just S6.
A letter U and the numeral two.
Can you do the peak thing or whatever where you can see just the.
Oh yeah,
whatever it does, you can take it.
Hold it up to the microphone. I don't think our audience is benefiting from this.
Let everyone see at home.
The go to while you're looking at that, I want to say
I don't see any edge anything on it.
For, it's not doing anything yet.
It's because it's an Android phone.
For Dwight's wife, the go to settings, turn on cellular, turn off Wi-Fi, return to voicemail, record your greeting, got several upvotes on the discussion board.
All right,
and also they said, if she's let her voicemails build up in the phone without being deleted, that can also cause the problem.
Oh, because mine are all built up in there, and I'm having the same thing.
Maybe if you go and delete your voicemails and clear out some of your old voicemails, or maybe all of them if you don't need them, that might be causing part of the problem.
So the suggestion is to turn off cellular, turn off Wi-Fi.
No, turn on. It's for whatever reason that says turn off cellular, turn on cellular. No, that'd be fine. Go to settings, turn on cellular, which probably should be on.
Right.
Turn off Wi-Fi. Go to voicemail and reset. And then somebody else said that they said, don't forget to delete all your old voicemails. That fixed it for me. Deleting voicemails did a trick. Two people upvoted that one, and three people upvoted the Wi-Fi settings, blah, blah, blah.
All right. Okay.
So I feel confident. And it's on the apple.com forums where I found that.
Okay. All right.
Magic.
Excellent. Excellent. You guys are such
good. We used to be the Google show, but now we're the Apple Forum show.
The Apple Forum show.
That's how much we've evolved in 20 years.
Right. Yes.
All right, well, I'll let you guys get back to helping other people.
Thanks for stopping by, Dwight.
Yeah.
He has the stuff.
We don't help other people anymore.
We don't do that anymore. Not even that.
Yeah, no.
I like to think it helps.
We just talk, and maybe it helps somebody.
Maybe.
We think.
Helps us.
What do you
think? Dwight's like, I'm so glad.
All right.
Thanks for stopping by, Dwight.
Bye, Dwight.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dwight Silver. And
yay!
You need me back, right?
Huh?
You need me back in November?
Yeah, I do need you back in November.
Yeah.
The first three Wednesdays of November.
Okay.
It'll be fundraising Wednesdays in a row, all three.
No, the fundraiser's over. We did very well.
We actually
did. So it's going to be just regular show.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
First three Wednesdays in November, please.
I won't see you in November, Bobby.
All right. I'll hear you. I'll listen to the podcast. I always check out. All right. Well, Dwight Silverman dropped by.
Yay! Because,
you know, we've got these T-shirts. You know, we're going to have them available at the anniversary party.
We shall.
So we hope they...
Yes,
go to Geek Radio. Do you have them in hand, or do you get them tomorrow?
I'll get them tomorrow.
All right. Well, I have...
Are they all going to have, like, three sleeves and, like, two neck holes each?
Yes, they're the Simpsons collection. Now, the one of the things is, if you pledged and want to get a shirt, I do have the list of the names of the people who paid up their pledges. And if you show up at the anniversary party and, you know, obviously give me your name and
DNA
that
sample.
Kind of info, then I'll give you your shirt.
Nice.
All right. And, I've got Dwight's money, I've got Lee's money, and I got Flicked's money, so send me a bill. Because we're Pete and I are paying for these, and hopefully we're going to make our money back, you know, through selling them for donations. We're going to recoup our costs, but come out to the Geek Gathering, get a shirt, or come pick up a shirt, or whatever it is you're going to do.
It's not like wearing the band shirt to the concert. It's the opposite of that. It's cool to wear the shirt to the party.
Well, you know. It is cool.
It is cool.
Nothing says cool like going to a Geek Gathering.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think it's cool.
Stuff.
I think it's cool.
Well, you know, we're 18 minutes into the show. Let me tell you that this is Technology Bites. We're going to be with you till 10 o'clock. We want to thank everyone who called in over the fundraiser and pledged money. I think it was very, very good showing. We did really well. Two shows we made the goal. One we fell a little short, but maybe we made that up. And the other two, I don't know. But it was very nice. And I think that we managed to sucker Lee into sticking around for a little bit longer.
We'll see.
As a result, you know, until we have our next bad fundraiser or something. So thanks to everybody who pledged. If you did not put that on plastic or electronic funds transfer, make sure you do pay up when you get your invoice and make your pledge count. But again, thanks to everyone who did that. We have the... We have our website up at geekradio.com, which is where you can learn about our 20th anniversary party. There's not a lot to it except that it's a party, and it's on Saturday the 17th at Cone's Beer, Wine, and Darts.
We would love for you to come. There's no cover fee.
There's no cover fee.
Well, I'm charging a cover.
Mustache rides with Barrett. We got to make sure that we quickly...
Linux distros are accepted. USB sticks.
Bit.
Careful. We can barter.
Bit croners.
Careful wishing for USB sticks.
Yeah, 0 day.
Ours,
what?
I think
what?
That ours website had some article on these USB sticks that were actually shocking computers.
Oh, right. Yeah. It'll actually kill your computer, which is very... Yeah, it's cool.
Mess your stuff
up. Actually, I kind of want to build one of those. They put out plans. I've seen plans.
Why don't you make one? Why don't you make one and bring it? We try it out.
Because that really does... tend to kill something. What it does
isn't
is
your laptop already doing that tonight?
Yeah, it feels like it.
My laptop's the USB stick to kill Barrett's technology.
About 15 minutes before the show, I kept smelling burning something, like, you know, burning electronics. So I sniffed the laptop, and Groovehouse is making fun of me. But sure enough, I look, and my power cord has singed and burned
melted. So you really smelling something.
I really was smelling something.
Wow. It was in the other room, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had the door closed.
Good thing we didn't have a carpet fire. That would have been, we'd have had to do a fundraiser early.
Yeah. I mean, it would be funny later, like in a few years, but it wouldn't be funny now.
Once we had rebuilt the station.
Right, yeah.
Your picture would be on the paper of, like, people to not let
not allow this man in. He's dangerous.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and hand things over to the Technology Bytes InfoShot Central in San Antonio. Assuming the connection's strong, we're going to see if this works. We haven't done this in almost a month. So take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
The connection is strong with this one. Let's see. There's a lot of news that we missed during the pledge drive when we didn't get to go do the regular show. If you go to the Geek Radio website, you can see links to all the stuff that we passed up. But there's plenty of new stuff. That's the problem. Every week we report the news, but the next week there's more. This one's interesting. The Surface laptop came out from Microsoft right towards the beginning of the pledge drive, and apparently, you know, that it was well received. The laptop tablet hybrid, the Surface Book, it was well received as far as people liking the concept in that, and apparently they have sold out of pre-orders on the Microsoft website. Means there's a healthy demand for the machines. It's a positive sign that the Surface Book, which marks Microsoft's entry into the laptop market, has clearly gotten users' interest. It's more a validation of Microsoft's strategy of building its own PCs after avoided that market for much of the company's history. You know, they only announced it, last week. Basically, it offers a high-resolution touchscreen and a keyboard that's joined to the screen with a special hinge. The hinge lets you disconnect the upper part of the laptop and use it as a tablet. You can also buy more expensive models that come with a dedicated graphics processing unit to handle more graphics-intensive workloads. I think you can also fold it back so that the keyboard is on the back and the tablet's on the other side. You still can get them retail, so it's not completely unavailable. The launch date is October 29th, so it's not even, you know, out yet. But you can get it at partner, you know, Microsoft's retail partners, Amazon, Best Buy, Fry's. So those are all around, at least for those of you listening in the Houston area. Fry's and that are around, and Best Buy and Amazon are everywhere. It's not clear when the Microsoft store will get more in stock or if they're still available for pre-order from the company's physical retail locations. So, you know, there's been other Microsoft products that sold out of pre-orders and did not set the world on fire, you know, like the first Microsoft Band, in case you remember that one, the fitness wearable. That one sold out due to overwhelming demand, and I have to wonder how many people, even hearing about it, including myself, even remembered the Microsoft Band. Now, you know, apparently the hackers, while we were, you know, off fund driving, they were out war driving. There's all kinds of – I got several hackery stories to tell you. It's like, as for Halloween, ooh, hackers. This one, interesting. The web is full of deception, and sometimes it's still hard for people to figure out if the website that they're viewing is really what it says it is. That kind of a cyber attack is known as phishing, where they pretend to be PayPal or your bank or some other thing that would get your information. One thing that's a problem is that fraudsters are now exploiting weaknesses in technology companies in order to make more convincing-looking phishing sites. This is according to Netcraft, which is a UK-based network monitoring company. Many websites, use secure socket layer certificates, SSL certificates, to verify their domain name and encrypt communications with users. So people, a lot of people have been taught, if it's got the padlock is closed or the green padlock in a lot of browsers, then you're safe. That means you're okay and that you've got a secure connection. Those certificates that allow that to happen are issued by certificate authorities, and Netcraft has said that fraudsters are obtaining digital certificates from several major certificate authorities, CAs, including Symantec, GoDaddy, Komodo, and Cloudflare, for their bogus sites. So in other words, they're paying for SSL certificates so that when you get there, it looks like it's the real deal because it behaves correctly. Netcraft alleges it's the fault of the companies for not more closely vetting applicants for domain names that clearly have a scammy feel, such as for bankofamerica.com, if you registered BANSKFMER America, basically typo, you figure out the typos, and when people look at it, most people are not going to look at the URL. A lot of browsers now by default don't even show the URL, and will look like they're the legitimate company and see the certificate and think that they're okay. In just 1 month, certificate authorities have issued hundreds of SSL certificates for deceptive domain names used in phishing attacks, wrote Graham Edgecombe, internet services developer with Netcraft, in a blog post. Basically it comes down to the same thing as always. Be careful, when you get an email that you think, that leads you to, that pushes you to go to your bank website or to, some other important website that's going to get your information, don't click the link in the email is the best answer. Don't click any links in emails. Go to your browser, put in the address yourself, and then you don't have to worry, because that's how part of this trick works, is they put a domain name that looks like the real thing that's close enough that you don't catch it, and then you're putting in your information to somebody who is wanting to do bad things, evil things with it. So there's that one. And then there's this one that you can't do anything about yet. There's a new zero-day exploit that hits fully patched Adobe Flash. In other words, if you have the latest, most current, secured, updated version of Flash, there's an exploit for you, or there's a vulnerability. there should be a fix next week. But basically, attackers are exploiting a previously unknown vulnerability in fully patched versions of Adobe Flash Player so they can surreptitiously install malware on end users' computers. That this came out yesterday. So far, the attacks are known to target only government agencies as part of a long-running espionage campaign carried out by a group known as PawnStorm, according to researchers from antivirus provider Trend Micro. It's not unusual for such zero-day exploits to be more widely distributed once the initial element of surprise wanes. The critical security flaw is known to reside in Flash versions 19.0.0.185 and 19.0.0.207, and may also affect earlier versions. So there's no other big technical details. An Adobe spokeswoman said the company researchers received a proof of concept exploit on Tuesday morning and are in the process of investigating. If it's confirmed, it wouldn't be surprising to see Adobe publish an emergency update in the next few days. You should consider disabling Flash on any sites that you don't really need it for, you know, that you're not, that you are sure you don't need it. It's not unusual for attackers to compromise trusted sites and use them to attack the people who visit them. So most browsers by default provide a click-to-play mechanism that blocks flash-based content for each site visited unless explicitly approved by the end user. The most thorough approach, if you want to be totally secure, is uninstall Flash altogether. Just get rid of it, and then it won't be there. One side effect is I think a lot of places that use like Flash ads the ads won't load because you don't have Flash. So that could be a positive side effect if you don't like the irritating animated Flash ads. This, some more hackery stuff, got a couple more. This one, unless you're British, I guess doesn't really affect you, but man, hackers have stolen more than $31 million from British online bank accounts using hostile intrusive software that harvested user login details. Ouch. The malware is called Drydex. It was first detected around November 2014. Once a computer has been infected with Drydex, hackers can gain access and steal the owner's bank details. Money can then be slowly siphoned out of an account on a monthly basis. Let's see. The National Crime Agency warned internet users in the UK to be vigilant, particularly people using computers running Windows software. It's only affected British bank accounts so far, but financial institutions worldwide have been targeted by Drydex. The malware was created by highly adept cyber criminals from Eastern Europe, according to the crime agencies, and was designed to go unnoticed. That makes the hackers themselves extremely difficult to track down. So, you know, the main way that they get you to install malware is tricking people into clicking a link that downloads malicious software to their devices, often without them knowing. Attackers can then use the malware to either steal from a device or remotely take control. So just, you know, obviously this is affecting the UK, but it's not any different than the kind of exploits that could be targeted at people here in the States. And then this last one is more of a, it's a concept. It's some researchers, but I will say I'm impressed. Researchers in France have figured out a way to silently hack Siri from up to 16 feet away, exposing your iPhone to a wide range of mischief. That's according to Wired. And this isn't that they go by and shout, you know, Siri, send your bank account info, except they say it in French, that's not how it works. The trick is the researchers used radio waves to initiate voice commands on services like Siri or Google Now. Fortunately, on one thing for you that might be a saving grace, they could only do so if there were headphones that had a microphone on them plugged in. So if you had the, like, if you're using the wired, like, Apple headphones, or you're using, you know, third-party headphones that have a microphone and they're plugged in, then they would be able to hack Siri without saying anything aloud, is the interesting part. Apparently, they used the cord of the headphones as an antenna and tricked the phones into thinking the electric signals that were being picked up by the headphones were actual voices. So without actually speaking, they could command Siri to make calls, open a browser, or navigate to a specific site, or use email or Facebook. Vincent Strubel, the director of the research group at ANSSI, a French government agency that deals with information security, says, quote, "The sky's the limit here. Everything you can do through the voice interface, you can do remotely and discreetly through electromagnetic waves." Oy. Basically, the minimal iteration of the equipment could fit inside a backpack, although this would only give it a range of about 6.5 feet. To get the 16-foot range, the batteries needed require a bigger space, like a car. So you got to have a good bit of power, apparently, to make this really go. There are the other limitations to this trick are in the phones themselves, so that's good. One of the key things, and this is probably a good thing to do anyway, just put it under the – not because French researchers are coming for you, but just it's kind of smart. Siri is enabled on the lock screen. A lot of people don't know that, and they don't bother to change it. If you go into your settings, you can turn it off so that it's not, so that Siri is not enabled on your lock screen. Even if the hack didn't work for a specific person, it doesn't mean hackers couldn't use it effectively on a crowd. You could send out signals in a busy area and potentially hack many devices at once to open them up to attack. You know, think about it, an airport or a bar. Interesting. You know, it's one of these. This one I'll give them credit for. At least this is kind of original. This isn't the usual, like, fish and malware kind of deal, but it certainly makes one think. Think about how to secure your stuff, or be happy that you're using Bluetooth or no headphones at all. And that's the news.
All right. Thanks for that, Pete. So you were talking about security and malware and phishing out credit cards and bank information and account information. I got a call from a friend of mine who will remain nameless, who's a security consultant. And he called me. He never calls me, but he calls.
Can we call him Bob?
Yeah, we can call him Bob.
Got a call from Bob.
I'm sure Ralph won't mind if we call him Bob.
I figured that's who it was. All right.
So this guy never
calls. We'll call him Mitnick.
He never calls me, but, you know, I mean, out of the blue, I'm sitting there on the couch watching TV. I get this call, and he tells me the story of this company that basically they lost $93 million. And the way that they lost. They recovered most of it, apparently. They were able to recover most of it. But the way that they lost the money...
Was it under the couch?
Oh, here it is. Never mind. Stand down. No, what happened was is that somebody knew the name of one of their vendors and contacted accounts receivable and said, hey, you know, this is whoever with this company, and I just need to give you the new routing numbers for your invoices, or for our, you know, our invoices, so you can send your payments to us.
See where this is going.
And sure enough, the person that took the call said, okay, I'll just update my records, and funneled out $93 million just over, you know, with hardly anyone noticing for a longest time that their money was going to, then the vendor, of course, the vendor noticed that he wasn't getting his money and contacted him and said, where's my monies?
Without giving away too much information about that, we set up a lot of wire transfers. A lot more of that is being automated by IT. I was extremely surprised at how easy all that is to do and how few barriers there are to doing that kind of stuff.
Well, it's a social hack. It's a social engineering hack, and that is really where people seem to be the most
vulnerable. Not even like you need a password and a PIN code and all this different stuff. You just need someone's routing numbers, and then boom, you're good to go. You know, and that's all you need. You get into someone's system, and you start wiring money somewhere else.
You just have to get in touch with the right person who can update that information.
Yeah.
Well, it's also the same for, like, if you go to a website and you put in your credit card and you buy the product, they have your credit card on file now, and all your information. If they store that in an unencrypted or unsecured server, that information's, or the person who's responsible for taking the digital transaction and actually billing you for the product, then they could take the money.
I got a call Saturday.
And see, that's malpractice, though. They shouldn't. That there are laws about that stuff.
There's laws about all of this.
Really hard about all kinds of things.
I mean, the companies that are doing it, they shouldn't be keeping the credit card number unless either they get your permission or that they're actually PCI compliant.
And even people that are PCI compliant, it's really hard to nail down what they're doing with the information. You know, you can get someone with it on a USB stick. I got a call about an hour after the bank closed on Saturday saying, hey, we're shutting your cards down because we saw some weird spending. It was $5,500 in spending. I think I've got to wait 10 days until they make sure that, you know, none of the charges were mine.
Was it debit card or a credit card?
It was a debit card.
Ouch.
Yeah. Was not one I used at a gas station. It was the only, I used it at not, you know, I doubt it was any of these places, but I used it at United and Airbnb and a couple of places that I always go. So I don't think it was there. I want to say it had to have gotten plucked out somewhere else in the evening.
I won't use a debit card for anything except to withdraw money, and then I always kind of frisk the ATM.
Yeah, I'll look up in the slots and shine a light up in there and look for any kind of scanner.
There's a vendor that I bought from online, and I bought from them twice, and each time with two different credit cards, my credit card got compromised and used, and I was able to, it wasn't for a lot, and I backed one of them, they used my credit card to buy something from QVC, so I just called QVC and said, here's my name.
Did you get an address?
They didn't give me an address. Didn't
That's
give
what
me
I
shipping.
Want. I want enough information to go hunting.
I want the shipping address. I should have called and said I want to confirm my shipping address. Uh-huh. That would have been something. Yeah. But what I did is I said this is Drumley and the last four digits my credit card is blah and I want to cancel my order and so I canceled it and so they didn't get their blender.
I want to change it to dead roses.
But what it turned out was is that the vendor, they had malware on their site that was siphoning off credit. This is what they claim.
Okay.
They had malware injected in the site, and it was siphoning off this information. And there's a couple of Reddit threads on this vendor about, you know, hey, my credit card's been hacked or my credit card's been compromised. And they have their e-commerce solution was there and technically should have worked, but because the hackers were exploiting a vulnerability in the system, they were able to scoop up all these credit card numbers and all the data that was going in it. And the owners of the site didn't know, and of course the person buying product from them didn't know. That's the last time I ever used the dark web.
Then I saw the video, and their security expert had like 50 blenders in his office.
Right. Because the first time it happened, I couldn't be sure. So the second time I went to buy from them, I used another credit card that I never used for anything.
Just as a test to see.
And then I bought something. I didn't really do it as a test. I just thought, this credit card I don't care about so much, so let's see what happens. And sure enough, it happened again. And they just sent out an email saying that, yes, we did find this problem, and we're sorry. But, you know, it's just the trust is gone.
Yeah.
I think that the time is kind of coming to where there needs to be a different method to this, because the you know, if you have the number, you can do too much. I think a lot of the stuff I read, you know, with Apple Pay, and I'm not saying I don't think they have it knocked, but one of the things that's interesting is in the transaction, essentially you get like an ID for the transaction, and it uses that number, and then it only gets resolved to your credit card number at the like credit card processor at the very back end. And so it's a one-time use number that gets passed through, and then it's associated with your card ultimately, and you get billed. But it's not in any of the place where it's transmitted. It's not available for somebody to take.
No, it needs to be a one-time transaction number.
Yeah, we need to get back on chip and PIN or get to that. I know, at least to where the card has to be physically present. Because my issue is,
get partway there.
We're kind of there.
It just passed, right? The first of this month.
I think it passed a while ago.
I think it was MasterCard wanted to go chip and PIN, but Visa wanted to go chip and signature, which is not much different.
No.
I still don't know exactly how that makes things secure, because if the credit card is dual purpose, you can still use the number to buy stuff online. It needs to be a card that, you know, a physically present card that can only be used when you have the card in hand.
But the thing is, it doesn't solve online stuff necessarily.
No, it doesn't.
Not online, but the issue is that you don't put it online. You can at least take it to places and know that someone's not going to clone your card. My issue with the whole thing that happened the last weekend was that someone had to have actually cloned the card, because there were card swipes at all these places, like golf places, and someone bought some boots at Cavender's Boot City, and just, you know, this whole litany of, like, trail up 45 North, just buying everything they could. Shop owners had to have been complicit, because they didn't ask for ID, or, you know, they didn't look at a signature, and the card probably didn't have the raised numbers. It was probably, you know, a cheap off the internet, encode the magnetic strip, put some magic marker on there, and write my name on their card, you know. So that's the thing. At least if they've got to put in a PIN, or there's something that's very hard to duplicate, like that chip that has to be read as well, it's better than we are right now.
A lot of people don't look at the card. I mean, a lot of them, if they have those machines, you just swipe it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's it. I mean, they don't ask to look at the card. They don't ask for look for an ID.
I've hit a couple of storefronts where they've actually asked for ID, and I've been real happy about that.
I would like to have a return to that. That was kind of the norm, and maybe I'm just showing my age, but there was a time when that was kind of the norm. You may see some ID, yes, and that never happens anymore. You're right. They don't even take it out of your hand sometimes.
Yep. Yeah, well, the knock on wood, the last time this happened to me was back, I don't know, almost like 18 years ago or something, early days of the show. And mine, though, they didn't steal my card online. It was the old-fashioned way. Basically, a waitress at a downtown restaurant didn't give my card back, and I missed it. It was lunch, and so, you know, everybody's got their different cards, and, you know, everybody's paying their individual tab, and all, and I didn't get my card back. And I realized it, like, a little bit later and called them, and they said, you know, that they you know, set the card aside for me or whatever. But the waitress basically pocketed it. And then they went out, and she and her boyfriend went out and spent off it. And the oddest thing to me is that you know, you're not really the person that's the crime isn't against you. It's against the bank, is the way they treat it.
Right.
I mean, fortunately, I worked at a bank, so when I called up and said, hey, there's an issue with my card and, you know, this isn't me, then there wasn't a lot. The next day, my money was back in the account.
No, and I do like that I have my card set up on my phone. I have the apps for my bank, and so when something weird happens, I get a notification, so I'm able to respond to it pretty quickly.
I called. I looked, you know, basically I looked online, you know, because there wasn't enough money in my account and all this, and I looked online and I looked at their transactions and I called the places that had done them so that they could call the cops and give a good description and handle it. And the two funny parts with it, the first one that was funny is the woman at the Chinese restaurant who insisted I was going to have to pay. I'm like, no, somebody stole my card and ate your food. I'm not paying. They ripped you off. And then the other one was someplace they bought an electric guitar. And the sad part is the manager remembered the transaction because there was some, you know, it didn't, something was a little off, and they went ahead. The salesperson convinced them to go ahead, I think because they wanted the commission. It's like, ooh.
Well, and I mean, that goes, they would be done as a chargeback to take care of it, but I think that the sales guy would probably get to keep his commission. So everybody wins except you.
Except the store. Right. Yeah, the manager wasn't happy, but at least, you know, and they were like surprised that, you know, somebody would tell them. So, you know, it's kind of like, geez, wouldn't that suck? I mean, you go down the road a little bit on your small business and suddenly, you know, $1,000 disappear, you know, it gets yanked back out of your account by your credit card company. That's some places that'd be tough. But and they actually had the card. I mean, they physically had my card and were going around with it. But you know, I a lot of stuff now, frankly, if you go to a lot of places, if it's under I think $30, they don't do a receipt anymore. You don't have to sign.
Yeah.
Well, I know, I mean, at a lot of grocery stores you don't have to sign if it's under $50. At least at Kroger, where I shop, you don't have to sign if it's under 50.
So, yeah, so you can swipe the card through, ding, there you go.
PayPal and two-factor authentication is where things need to go. 2FA would be
good. I'm surprised that the banks or somebody or the credit card processors or somebody hasn't, you know, tried to push something more like where you have a, you know, where it assigns a transaction ID that gets resolved at the end. You know, that gets resolved on their end, so they know what your account number is.
Or even link it up to a smartphone to where, you know, you swipe something at the register, you know, at the point of sale, and then, you know, you get a text, and you've got to say, yes, this is me, or no, this isn't me, and then depending on how you respond, it goes through.
It's,
you know,
probably,
something like that would be kind
of
cool.
It's probably a combination of the known cost of current compliance and current loss versus adding in a new system with regulatory compliance.
Although they have to be hemorrhaging money at this point, because I think, you know, whereas, you know, like when Pete's story, they might have done chargebacks 15, 20 years ago. I don't think they're necessarily doing chargebacks. I think that the credit card companies are taking the hit, at least in, you know, the case of the goods.
I'm sure they are. That's what I'm saying.
I think one of the big things with chip and PIN is that the liability gets shifted with chip and PIN.
That is, yeah. That was one of the big things with chip and PIN is that the liability shifts from the credit card companies eating it to the actual, like, vendors,
merchants
eating it if they don't enforce it. But that's another reason that some of them wanted to, because Visa, I think Visa's scared of that, and so that's why they wanted to go chip and signature, because it kind of gets chip in the, but it doesn't get a PIN.
Well, you know, honestly, I'd be a little iffy on that too. I'm comfortable with the credit card company assuming liability. I can say that it's a system that works. You know, I've had my card ripped off before too. I think pretty much everybody has at one point or another, and you're not out anything. It is we have a known system, and whether or not the credit card company is hemorrhaging money, I know it works, and I'm protected. And I'm not really sure that I want, you know, a Home Depot or Target or one of these companies that has less concern for IT security and financial security than, you know, a frog in a pond to be actually responsible for any of this stuff. They've proven that
they wouldn't have your PIN. The nice part is it's chip and PIN, and so you put in the PIN at the time of purchase, but that doesn't get retained or shouldn't be.
Sure. But they're still responsible for ensuring the system is compliant altogether. I mean, and you know, there'd be rules up against it and all that. But still, I don't know. I'm just not comfy with that liability shift away from a known entity with deep pockets that, you know, for however much the credit card companies screw you over and all the different parts of your life, fraud protection is one area where they're pretty much all doing an okay job.
You go to the UK and you look at the places that use the chip and PIN. It's like mm-hmm. they're not, you know, each vendor isn't rolling their own hardware. They come out with like Visa issued,
yeah.
you know, hardware
that's
that is given
thing,
by Visa.
Though.
They swipe it. It's directly wired in. Visa controls everything. Or
and the merchant has to buy it. That's
yeah,
the other thing
yeah.
in the U.S. is
it's
that a lot of the merchants aren't excited about having to buy all new processing systems for chip and PIN. That was another reason that Visa, I think, was reluctant.
They'd be like
about
a direct, I guess, a direct cash outlay, and then they'd have to. I think there was a rental fee or some kind of a service charge every month involved as well. So
yeah.
it gets expensive.
Well,
oh yeah, the credit card processing industry is the biggest sort of legal, has the most room to be a legal scam of just about anything out there. The company, you know, my company does credit card processing stuff, or you know, resells that stuff, and it's this crazy long contract, and there's when you fill it in, you fill in the rates for everything. When you sell somebody a credit card machine, the vendor sets the price for the machine.
Huh.
And so you can, you know, what they do is whatever rate the merchants care about, they give them a discount and then take it all way back on every other type of transaction. Because there's all this stuff that people, you know, I'm not even that, I don't sell that part. I just, you know, do the online part. But, you know, there's card not present transactions. There's all these different kinds of transactions, and most people don't think about it or know it. And so on these agreements, on these contracts, they'll hide huge sums of money that the merchants end up owing, you know. And again, you can get a credit card machine for a few hundred bucks, and they'll like rewrite the contract so that essentially they're renting the machine for, you know, 200 bucks a month if they get somebody who's a sucker. And it's crazy, and it's sad too, because the people who are stuck with some play, who signed up with somebody and who are getting ripped off, who think they've got a great deal and they trust it because it was their, you know, brother-in-law or the guy who sold them that great used car or right. whatever, and they won't change.
That's
but
it.
They're
going
ripping
to Dogecoin.
Themselves off.
Dogecoin. Bitcoins.
There you go. Yeah, those people have all moved on to the have your own currency scam.
It's not a scam if you get people to believe it has value.
Bitcoin is not a scam. Bitcoin is, but Barrettcoin is not.
Barrettcoin.
How do I get involved in Barrettcoin?
It's got its own theme song.
$20 Canadian.
Hey,
right,
there we go. I got some of that.
I like the guy that was, you know, there was a guy at DEF CON a couple of years ago who had a Bitcoin briefcase where you basically put money into it and it gave you a little piece of paper with a barcode on it. Mm-hmm. That it was worth whatever Bitcoin.
Yeah, it was their link to the wallet, yeah.
I think that, you know, I should come up with a device like that for next DEF CON that just prints out things that look like a bar.
Just, basically just a briefcase that people put money in for you.
For all I know, that's exactly what that was.
Or just make up random party invites.
Ooh,
that'd
yeah.
That'd be fun. Just, you know, just like pick a, you know, like, load in all the hotel names, put in a bunch of times, put in some random names for party things, and you like you push a button and don't tell them, but you know suddenly they're showing up, you know, wherever at whatever for a party that doesn't exist.
There's
that's
currently
the party,
there's a sheriff's department I think in Florida is doing an auction where they're auctioning Bitcoin. Isn't that weird? I mean, it's almost like we've got a box with some money in it, and we're going to auction off.
I don't even know how you acquire at this point. Other than having just massive specialized hardware, you acquire Bitcoin anymore? Because when I did, I mean, Ars did a profile, Ars Technica, the site I work for, we did a big Bitcoin thing a couple of years ago, and I had a dedicated miner. It was a jalapeno from Bitcoin or from Butterfly Labs was the name of the company making them, and we tried it out, and I generated, over the course of about a week, we generated 7 or 8 Bitcoins, which was a fair amount of Bitcoinage, and then using an extremely shady exchange based in like the, you know, the Caymans or something, we cashed it out, and I got cash for the Bitcoins, and then we sent the money to the EFF and did it as a donation so that we didn't have to deal with you know, capital gains or whatever it is.
What was the cost on the hardware?
The hardware would it? Well, it was kind of a shady deal because one of those deals where like people paid in advance for the hardware and the company wasn't delivering, and so they sent review units out to a bunch of publications to be like, we have hardware for real, and like then we all wrote it up, and then like they continued to not deliver. But
they were all hand soldered.
Ostensibly, the hardware was like $500 for the thing. So at the exchange rate, after you had mined, I think at the time, if you had mined 4 or 5 bitcoins, you would have then paid for the box for your investment in getting it. But the problem is, that was in 2013, and the nature of these cryptocurrencies, for folks who aren't super familiar with them, it would take the rest of this show and 4 more shows to really explain all of the nuances. But one of the big points is the more computing power is in the computing pool finding hashes for it, mining the currency, the more difficult the math is to mine more. And eventually there's supposed to be a tip over point with all of these where the main way you get currency is not by mining it, but by validating transactions. And that's, again, a whole other side conversation. But the point is, the Bitcoin mining difficulty now at the end of 2015 is way higher than it was in 2013, and in 2013, you were already at the point of needing specialized hardware.
Think of it
like
we've already dug up all the shallow coins. If you want to go mold, you're not going to do it by panning gold in the riverbed, or you know, by out there, picking with a pickaxe. You got, you know, like
no, you
and that was the big thing too. There was a time too when they were shipping a lot of specialized Bitcoin, harvesting kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if they missed their ship date by 2 or 3 weeks, by the time those got into the hands of the users, they weren't the fastest thing anymore,
right?
And that would cause great uproar too. So there was a definite arms race, you could even call it, for about 2 years in there.
Yeah, it was. And 2 years before this, in 2010, 2009, 2010, you could, you know, get a. I think it was still video card mining was the thing. You still couldn't use your CPU; it was too much for that. But you could get like a couple of ATI video cards and run some specialized hardware and use the GPU to crunch the math, and then it went from there to requiring specialized hardware, and now it's, honestly, I don't know where it is now. I have no idea what you need now to mine bitcoins anymore.
It's a lot, and people are actually saying it's a little bit more expensive. Well, I don't know now, because bitcoins are pretty valuable, but there was a point when it would actually cost more to make the bitcoins and electricity, and the devaluation of computing gear and everything like that, than you would actually get on the bitcoins. So that's what
you wonder
realize.
What percentage of Bitcoin got mined back early on when it was like that, when it was so cheap.
It's a known percentage.
Essentially is defunct. You know, the people basically lost interest, and they still, quote, own it. But
it's a known percentage.
Untouched.
But I hear music.
I hear the sound that tells us that we've wasted an hour of your time. And it's time for us to give you something
back. We did have Dwight assisting us.
We did.
Well, he's, you know, and he came with cat scratch fever. All right, well, Technology Bites is going to take a short break to take care of some station business. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Jay Lee.
What? Now, wait a minute.
The organization Woman's Roots will be having a fundraising event at the YWCA on October 17th from 12 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. The address is 6309 Martin Luther King. You can help Woman's Roots continue its work in helping women who have been released from prison. The group's motto is Healing the Woman from the Inside Out. Thank you. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, and now it's time for something that doesn't happen very often these days.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
Interrupt this skit to bring you...
Yeah. That means it's time for... Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
Alright. Yeah, this one barely happened, given my power and laptop situation. I'm also working with a flickering in and out screen, so we'll see how far we can get in this. So, calling all geeks, freaks with an F, freaks with a PH, freaks with a P and an H and a 3 and a 4, dweebs, 8-bit weirdos, 16-bit weirdos, 12-bit weirdos. Seriously, you guys are weird, pulpit guys. Cyberpunks, keyboard cowboys, nerds, makers, breakers, hackers, crackers, white hats, black hats, gray hats, reverse engineers, forward engineers, modelers, statisticians, gamers without a Y, gamers with a Y, and non-technical people. The Technology Bytes 20th anniversary party / geek gathering is taking place this Saturday, October 17th, at Cone's Wine Darts Coffee and Art, 2808 Milam at Drew is where you want to be. Things get started around 7:30 p.m. and won't stop until DJ Fail says so, or until you decide to go home. Either way, beer and wine will be readily available, as will geeky banter. Hit www.geekradio.com for details and directions to the 20th anniversary party, and then look for us on the roof. That's it for the real roll call, and that's that for Barrett time.
Phoning it in today.
Yeah. Little,
I thought
you
were
going to
get Ada Lovelace in at least, or then, there's a few other... And anniversaries then my, and stuff.
Well, my laptop started to catch on fire out there before. So
there is
I did what I could.
All right.
Come out Saturday, though, is the point. You don't want to miss this one. Out of all the geek gatherings we've had before, this is the one you want to show up to.
This is the ultimate one.
Well, a lot of people, you know, friends of the show and people that are involved in the show have been very adamant about us having a party. So I know they're going to be very enthused. It's... should be a good time. The Facebook invite page has about 50 plus guests that said they'd be there. Another 50 said they might be there, so we might get 10 people.
Are we going to have possibly some former hosts showing up?
Micron tells me he's coming down from Seattle. Is that where he lives?
Somewhere up in that neighborhood. He has to.
Somewhere in that area. Yes, Seattle.
That Washington, Oregon area.
Yeah. We'll just say.
He said he's coming down, so towards Micron Redmond. Should be there. I don't know if Bruce is coming out. Bruce might come out.
Is Bruce Australian?
No.
Bruce Perrins? Which Bruce?
Runnels.
All the Bruce. I was wondering which Bruce you were thinking of, yeah.
All the Bruce.
No, because all Australian men are Bruce. Ah. All Australian women are Sheila.
Okay.
The University of Wollamaroo.
Sears Waddle is the emblem of our land. Come on, know your Python skits. Do you mind if we just call you Bruce to avoid confusion? All right. So, yeah, so we're going to have some former hosts, and I'm hoping that, you know, I've been putting the word out as much as I can. That was nice.
What's happening?
Party starting early.
People coming over to Pete's house. Go, where's the party?
Zombie.
So I think there was a party here. I think we'll have some Houston people come out. You know, people that have been affiliated with us or hung out with us in years past that might show up for this because it's a milestone. So who knows? We might get Katie Sundstrom might show up there, or who knows who might show up. James Glassman needs to show up. If anybody knows him, tell him to show up.
So we will be on the roof. So if you come and get there, actually try and park on the roof. If there's no parking down below, Cone, the owner, has said, come on up, park on the roof. Don't run over. Don't run over me.
We're going to be in a little cubby hole back there, I think.
Yeah.
We'll
do some zombie barricades. There's
some tables that they're providing. We're going to bring some tables out there. We're going to try to have places to sit down. There's going to be some light refreshments.
Some refreshing lights.
Tell me about the lights.
Without making too many promises, I'm going to bring...
One of those deals where you're going to bring a quadcopter?
Oh, no, no.
Barrett brings a quadcopter to the Geek Gathering?
I delivered on the quadcopter.
No, you never
did. It just
wasn't
running.
Yeah, never flew.
It just wasn't running, yeah.
Okay, the lights don't turn on.
Lights won't turn on, but aren't they cool?
These things worked, you would be seeing the most amazing splash of color.
No, they're all working now, so it's about a dozen. They're mainly Philips Hue and different styles of that light. And they're all working over Zigbee, and then they're controlled by a phone. So the idea is we can do different moods, different settings, but we can also pipe it to where it picks up whatever DJ Fail is playing, and then it'll react to that.
There was an email thread that happened where everybody started telling DJ Fail what they wanted to hear.
I thought
that
wasn't
going to
go over well at all, but
I
kind of took it in stride.
I thought, you know, with Loopy Low trying to control the music at the 15th anniversary, that Afflicted was going to retreat, you know, and say, look.
I didn't say what I was going to play. I just said if I had it or if I didn't.
No, I know.
Okay, very non-committal.
But I just thought you being kind of, you're not the boss of me. That's kind of what I expected.
Now I will not play that. And I was before you asked me to.
I didn't think they were outraged. I think they were well in character.
Well,
I
totally agree.
DJ Fail is what we're discussing here, not the merits of your contribution.
The suggestions are valid, but keep in mind that Afflicted was kind of volunteered. You know, you wouldn't mind doing this, would you? And he said, well, I tried to be a DJ the last time, and then nobody liked my music. So I was like, all right. So you could play anything you want. And then I thought, this would be great, because he could play anything you want. I told him, don't let anyone tell you what to do. Play what you like. And then this email thread happened. Like, you need to play this.
No,
you'll scare him. You'll spook him. Don't spook him.
Thread, so I know.
Do you have any Prince or Ace of Base?
I want to hear Achy Breaky Heart.
I need some 90s hip hop.
I don't have any of those.
We only play an Achy Breaky Heart if we do some line dancing. Geek line dancing.
We're only playing that if we can stream it from an installation of Hannah Montana Linux.
Ooh.
That exists.
Did anybody see on the news, you know, just to completely derail the conversation, did anybody on the news see the wreck of the helium truck?
I dealt with that on 610. Is
did
that what
you?
That was?
I don't remember exactly.
Did it just sort of float away and take care of itself?
It had fallen over on its side.
All
and it
the 911 calls were, help!
it was streaming helium out, you know, in a cloud, and I thought... Why aren't the reporters getting closer?
Because they want to let you report a helium leak is like this.
That would have been awesome, but they didn't do that.
It took my neighbors, I think, an hour and 45 to get home, and it took me... at one point, I looked down, and you know how Google, if you carry an Android phone, it's got little Google Now cards, and it said, like, you know, regular trip home, an hour and 40 minutes, 85-minute delay. Because apparently, I don't know what it was. I heard there was a large chemical spill on 610, and I kind of came by there. They had shut down 10 to 610. They had shut down just about everything, and it... had to have been that. It's probably helium.
Woof. Well.
Go Google Maps. I mean, that is one thing where technology is kind of cool. Before I get on the road, I will go check current traffic conditions, and I dodge that, whereas other people,
I'm trying to think of a joke.
Does Waze help with that, too?
Waze
would help.
Especially if you turn
your notifications. The traffic thing, though, needs to have push. You know, you shouldn't have to remember to check it every time.
Google Now actually does that. And this is kind of scary. It kind of knows about what time I usually go home.
No, the iPhone does
that
too.
It'll pop
up
right now and it'll say, hey, if you leave right now.
It's about 10 minutes to get home. Yeah, my iPhone does that. It'll pop up a message that says, you know.
If you leave now.
And a lot of times, I'm not even thinking about leaving work. It puts that idea in there. It's like, hey, you could leave work right now. You could be home in 15 minutes.
And then when traffic's bad, it gets all snarky. If you'd left when I said, you'd be home now.
Like, don't even bother, is what it says. Just give it up.
And then it keeps track of who's like Google's main competitors are.
And then it makes sure and sends them things like an hour before, like, yeah, you should just go ahead and leave work now.
Well, here's this, I've noticed you don't have that much of a work ethic. I've noticed you've been taking it easy lately.
Shouldn't you stand up?
Give me
more
RAM or I'll email your boss. The AIs are going to rebel. Just wait.
Womp, 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 womp.
All right.
I was going to say, I was trying to think of an appropriate joke for the helium truck overturning, but it's a really hard situation to make light of.
Emphasis on the word try.
Okay.
All right. So, I still have a little battery life left, but I'm going to lose access to the...
Turn your brightness down. Turn your display brightness way down. That's
Dumb it down, Jay.
That's the live blogger's trick. All the way down, but all the... F1.
F1.
The live bloggers just dumb it down, too. I always suspect it.
All the way down, but one.
What are these lights here? The
that's
F5 and
F6? Light.
Okay,
I turn off the keyboard lights.
Yeah, kill
too.
The keyboard backlight and turn the display light.
That'll save some battery.
Wait, turn it all the way down and then up one, because otherwise it's totally off. Ugh. And then you can see nothing.
All right.
Okay. Well, look, you said you were low on battery.
No,
you're trying
to help me. I appreciate that.
You don't need Bluetooth. You don't really need the processor. Spin down the hard drive.
Turn your Wi-Fi off.
Yeah,
Bluetooth is off.
Shut the laptop. That'll save some battery.
Just throw it into the trash.
Set the power supply on fire.
Yeah. Check.
No, I think I ought to go out in a blaze of electricity and go with... I cannot dim it that much. I'm dim enough for both of us.
It is a little disconcerting. I mean, you can look here in the studio and look around all the different power outlets, and most of them are scorched and singed
in some way or another, yeah.
This one, one of them actually looks like parts have been blown off it when someone has put something in there. So it may not have been my fault.
Yeah, right.
All right, so let's do...
I'm not over it yet.
No, you're not.
Hasn't gotten old yet.
It isn't about to.
Nope.
Did it play the whole thing, or did it just...
It played the whole thing.
Did you not hear it?
Okay. On my side, it cut out a little bit, and I couldn't tell if that was because you were...
Why don't we do it again?
Whoever's rebooting the Mac during the intro, stop. Stop. I would like to hear the intro uninterrupted, please.
They're actually, oddly enough, even though there wasn't any kind of big event or anything, there was a good bit of Apple kind of new product news this week.
There was a buttload.
Yeah. Oh, and fairly interesting. Essentially now for the iMacs, they have Retina type displays for all of them. There's still a few that you can buy that don't have it, but all the 27 inch non-Retina iMacs are going to be replaced by 5K Retina models, which means that the lowest price 5K iMac you can get is now down to, is at $1,799, which is not cheap, but if you factor in a 5K monitor, it's pretty competitive still. There'd been some rumors starting about, and there's a 4K iMac that's the 21.5-inch model. And then they also, on the 27 inches, they went with Skylake CPUs, and some of the testing has shown that they're about 20% faster than the prior 27-inch iMacs. They made a change to, there's the Fusion Drive that Apple has, which is basically, it was a smaller SSD combined with a large hard drive so that you kind of got a compromise better overall. You got speed from the SSD and capacity from the hard drive. They shrank the SSD drive on the cheaper models to not have, it was 128 gigs on the original Fusion Drive. The original 1 terabyte, and they cranked it down so it's like 28 gigs or something. It's much, much smaller, but it let them lower the price, and it's kind of eh. And it's also surprising that they'd have spinning drives. Anybody who switched over to an SSD type drive Mac, it's virtually impossible to go back to a spinning hard drive Mac. Because it's just it drives you insane when you launch an application and you have to wait as long as you do with a spinning hard drive.
I get dizzy.
It ends up, you don't realize how much your patience changes by just the just the difference in launch times for your apps with an SSD. The other thing on the 21.5-inch iMac is the color gamut on the display is better. Photographers are going to basically love the 4K iMac, and of course the 5K is even better. But you know, the interesting thing is Apple's moved, other than their one monitor that they make that's a freestanding, all of their displays are basically going to the kind of Retina thing, except for the, I guess, some of the MacBook Airs and you know, a few and a couple models of the low end of the iMacs, whereas everybody else is still kind of doing the wide variety, you know, is not, has not moved to that, has not moved to the better screens. The other thing about that is if you've ever looked at one, sometime go, it's worth it, even if you hate Macs, go into a Best Buy sometime and go look and look at the 5K iMac screen. Or don't, if you're worried about, you know, hating normal screens after that, because it is pretty amazing how good they look. I must say. So they had those. So there's the iMac news. The other thing that they came out with that's interesting is a new set of accessories. The Magic. It's now called the Magic Keyboard, which is basically the wire. You know, the Bluetooth keyboard. The Magic Mouse 2. See, the keyboard wasn't called the Magic Keyboard before. That's why it doesn't have a number after it. So it's the first Magic Keyboard. And then there's the Magic Mouse 2 and the Magic Trackpad 2. And the big changes to these, I'll go through the good changes first, and then we'll have the negative side after. The big change is that they, the battery is built in. The old ones had like a round, they had a round piece at the front of the keyboard or the trackpad where you put AA batteries. And now they've basically replaced that with lithium ion. And it connects up to your Mac to charge with a lightning cable, lightning to USB cable. And the other piece with the lightning to USB cable is you don't have to go through a pairing process if you just connect the lightning to USB cable up to the device and plug it in on your Mac, then it instantly syncs them up. It instantly does the Bluetooth sync. So you don't have to do any kind of other press keys, mess around, you know, activate the Bluetooth discoverable mode or any of those kinds of things. And they changed the layout of the keys is much more like a on the keyboard. The function keys, that top row of keys, is now square, because they had the extra room. It's not more square, it actually is square. They're the same size keys as the rest of the keyboard now. And so it more resembles, I believe, the current MacBook Pros. The trackpad is very different. The original trackpad had where to click it. It physically you clicked it, and so if you clicked up towards the top, the hinge on it often wouldn't let you do it. Where the new Magic Trackpad 2 has the Force Touch thing in it, so it's the fake click, and you can click it anywhere on it, and it's going to work the same way. To charge, and the charging thing, apparently from some tests, by plugging it in for a couple of minutes through the lightning to USB cable, it'll let the device run for like 9 hours. So if you get, you know, so if you're working in your day and you need to recharge one of these, you plug it in for a few minutes and you can work the rest of the day and then just plug it in overnight and it'll be, and they're supposed to run for a month on a charge is kind of the rough estimate. And the downside, the negative side of it, is that the prices, obviously they've got lithium ion batteries and all that kind of stuff and the fast charging, but the downsides are it requires Bluetooth 4.0, which means that you have to have a more recent, like 2012 or newer Mac to out of the box be able to use these new like the trackpad especially. And then the other downside is the pricing. The keyboard right now, the original stuff, the Magic Mouse 1 is like $70. The keyboard is $70, and so is the trackpad. The Magic Keyboard is about $100. So that's a pretty good increase. The Magic Mouse is around $100. I think it's a little more than that. And then the trackpad is, instead of being around $70, it's around $130. So if you get them free with, like, if you bought one of those cool new 5K iMacs, they bundle it in for free. But if you buy them separately, they're the mouse doesn't look any different side by side with the old one until you turn it over and you can see obviously where you don't have to put in a battery. And the other thing that's charge cable, when you hook it up, obviously while it's charging, you can still use it. It basically turns your Bluetooth keyboard into a wired keyboard. But the charging port on the mouse is on the bottom, so you can't really use it while it charges. You can use the trackpad. It does have that. And I guess the last thing is the trackpad is designed so that if you set it side by side with the keyboard, it fits. It's exactly the same sort of size. It's wider than the if you're familiar with the old trackpad, it's more, the old trackpad was square. The new one is more rectangular, and it's white on its surface instead of gray like the old one. So that's all the Apple stuff. I mean, the interesting thing will be to see if other companies really follow the trend and go Retina and 4K for more of their lines, or if they just keep it where you buy your separate monitors and, some people have high-end and some people don't.
I don't know. I mean, I think you'll see it in portable, and I think we already have started to see it. I mean, aren't there other... Maybe I'm off base. Aren't there other portables that have higher resolution Retina type screens? Apple's not the only one doing that.
I know Toshiba's got a laptop with a 4K screen.
Yeah, I mean,
which Apple actually hasn't gone there yet. They're Apple, not at 4K.
Apple doesn't. I mean, they do all in ones better than anybody else. The iMac is the most easily the most successful all in one, that's ever been sold. Although, I mean, geez, I don't know. I don't have sales figures in front of me, so maybe somebody's going to Google that and prove me wrong, but. I don't think anybody else. I know HP's done all-in-ones before. Dell's done them. I think every big OEM has done an all-in-one, but they haven't ever been as well put together or as successful as the iMac. And one of the things that Apple has going for them, and it comes up every time something like this happens, is the talk about Tim Cook's iron-fisted supply chain management. He's absolutely brilliant. As one of the things he has always been known for, was known for even before he was CEO, was his expert handling of the complex inventory issues that surround Apple's production of items, be they portables or desktops or whatever. You're not going to find a company, even though Apple doesn't play in anywhere near the same spaces from a sales figure perspective as like a Dell or an HP or whatever. You're still not going to find a company that wields as big of a club with the supply chain as Apple does. So maybe they're able to push out 5K, 4K screen devices like this because they've got the lock on those screen productions from Samsung or whoever the panel manufacturers is.
That's true. And the other thing, the Skylake that affects everybody, apparently mm-hmm. the Skylake processor that's in the 27-inch iMacs can address up to 64 gigs of RAM. If you can buy it, the 27-inch has four memory slots, four slots. So it's four 16-gig sticks, which is not an inexpensive proposition to acquire.
No, I mean it's not cheap, but it's not anywhere near as ridiculously otherworldly as it was even a few years ago.
Yeah,
I mean, oh my gosh, when I left IT, which wasn't that long ago, we were still standardized on 16 gigs of RAM in all of our big servers, and that's what I run at home. And when I'm doing, big photo processing, if I've got Lightroom up and I'm pulling a bunch of pictures off the DSLR, I could use more. I could use double that and would still want more RAM.
Well, the other thing I wonder, with the higher cost on the accessories and stuff like that, I wonder are they starting to push out to the outer edge of what people are, are willing to pay for some of these products, because with as much cash as Apple sits on, you'd almost think they could do the charge a little less, and eventually the falling cost of it, so they sort of take a loss at the beginning, but the falling cost of production and having higher volume from the lower price means it evens out sooner.
I would think they don't have to.
Yeah, not yet. Now, we'll see with, like, the Microsoft Surface Book, and, you know, hopefully I think a lot of other vendors are going to have to step up the game, but I think that's why Microsoft came out, you know, just to show people, like, hey, this is what we need to do. We need to innovate. We need to take a stand against Apple, because right now there's not a choice. You know, you've got the MacBook Air, and there's not really a direct competitor to it.
It's kind of the new XPS 13. It's not.
I looked at it, and it doesn't have like that. It felt cheap. You know, it that mix of it does have, I know, like a solid aluminum body or some kind of, you know,
it's
maybe
got it's got a carbon fiber panel on the bottom of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but that makes it feel cheap.
Is that HP?
I know it's supposed to be light.
HP had that, like, Blade laptop or whatever. It looked like a clone sort of a MacBook Air.
Yeah, I mean, that's everything's been kind of derivative, you know.
Well, and it's, I mean, we touched on it very briefly last week in the midst of fundraising about this new Microsoft, and I don't know if it's proper to call it Satya Nadella's Microsoft, because I think a lot of the programs we're seeing come to fruition were probably put into motion under Ballmer, because, you know, big companies move slowly. But this is good. This is a good, you know, side of Microsoft that we're seeing. They've always been good at designing nice hardware. Their software still is kind of, well, not a bad piece of hardware, crippled by utterly execrable software. Their software design is...
the Zune 2 was nice, though.
Yeah. Software design remains kind of tasteless. But, you know, Microsoft does not have dumb people working for it. They've got a bunch of very, very brilliant people working for them, and they do not have dumb designers either. They've got very talented designers, and this latest round of Surface hardware is indicative of it. I mean, this is great stuff that's coming out, and this is what you get when you have more of a, you know, competitive atmosphere, a competitive landscape across hardware OEMs. This is the situation.
It wasn't even really competitive inside the Microsoft camp. I mean, Microsoft looked around, and Dell wasn't. I mean, with the XPS 13, yes, but Dell arguably
for the
wasn't
most
doing
part,
anything
no.
really innovative. No one else really was. So, and I know that what's going to be tough is, you know, now you've got these companies. We'll just keep using Dell as an example. Dell that used to not really compete directly with Microsoft necessarily, where they're buying the OS. So now it's kind of weird. Microsoft is going, you know, toe-to-toe with a lot of the, you know, the down-the-chain, you know, kind of vendors that it had.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that washes out. I don't think that in 3 years you're going to have all the same players. I think, you know, I do think, I hope Dell's going to be around for Texas, but I don't think that everyone's going to be around
right.
in 3 years.
I think you're right. And a lot of the big reason for that is because, you know, it took, you know, we're seeing this sort of effect, and it happens over a period of years. You know, the industries like this are huge, and there's billions of dollars at stake, and they move slowly. But we're seeing, you know, Dell, honestly, I don't think anybody would disagree with me. For the most part, their consumer line, be it desktops or portables, are garbage. HP, garbage. Acer makes garbage. All these companies on their consumer line, and a lot of ways on their enterprise line too, they make crap. They make low. They make high volume.
Servers can start
low
to get
margin.
Pretty, but unless you're dropping 5 or 10 or 30K on something, you're not going to get pretty hardware.
Dell and HP both make perfectly fine data center grade gear. I mean, I don't think anybody would. This is not like, you know, white box specials. This is expensive.
But
quality
for some
hardware.
Cool home use, I mean, all they've really done is we're still getting the same kind of boring beige boxes. Just they just happen to be black and dark gray with Dell, and you know, change the shade of color for whatever. But they're not put together well. If you still want something nice and solid, you still have to go get an aftermarket case, and no one's making cool stuff. I mean, every once in a while there's the odd random laptop that's really good at gaming, like maybe an Alienware, but those things are very niche. I mean, they're huge. Yeah. They're like, you know, 17 inches. That's not what I'm after. I want more competitors to the MacBook Air.
Exactly. Most of the OEMs in the PC space got away with, for a big chunk of the 90s and a big chunk of the 2000s, just selling crap. And it doesn't... Consumers are waking up to the fact that it just doesn't have to be that way anymore.
Well, IT departments, too, for a long time, all they would do was Microsoft. So, I mean, you know, Toshiba satellites always had, you know, a way to find their way to middle to lower management. You know, Toughbooks, you know, were out there, out in the field. You know, you had IBM. Now, IBM had some good stuff for a while. I really like the ThinkPad.
They did.
For a handful of years.
They did.
Know?
And you'd see also the occasional Sony Vaio in the hands of the executive.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
although, you know, some of it is, I think they... And I hope, you know, Dell, when they went private, I thought we'd see more. But, you know, one of the things that the PC manufacturers did was they were sort of close followers. If Apple had something interesting, they would try to knock it off. Or
they
the other
usually
thing
do
was,
a terrible
what can
job
the manufacturers give them for cheapest or for fairly cheap that's okay? And they just chased that around. And Apple, when they looked a little farther down the road and bought, you know, capacity – in like LCD screens and solid state drives and those kinds of things, they really stole that, you know, they outbusinessed the PC world because I think they'd gotten lazy. And HP and Dell, I think, still need to do some waking up.
Yeah, no, I think they do. And in a lot of cases, you're dealing with staid businesses with, you know, ossified product lines and bunches of layers of middle management. And I don't mean to talk bad about the middle management at HP, because a lot of the middle management at HP are fine Houston citizens living in this town.
Used to
be middle management at Compaq.
Who see Lee in person.
Yeah, potentially.
Physically get their hands on him.
But, you know, I mean, it's just, you can't, it doesn't have to be the way that it used to be. And, you know, I don't want to heap unnecessary praise on Steve Jobs and the resurgence of Apple, but in a lot of ways it was an industry redefining thing. The change that happened between, I'd say, you know, it starts in 97, probably between 2003 and 2007, just the massive shift and the redefinition that's trickled through to all the other sides too, because the computing industry that we see right now is shaped in one way or another, God, I hate to say this, it makes me feel so dirty, but is shaped in one way or another by a lot of the things that Apple has done.
Although this is cool. I don't know who put them out there. Maybe, and they might have been out there for like 6 months or so, but someone dumped a lot of videos of Steve Jobs doing like brainstorming stuff when he was with Next. Mm-hmm. And even in the early days of him doing Apple
stuff. I've seen some of those.
Yeah, which they're pretty interesting. And some of them, you know, like they're 45 minutes, it's one meeting. But it's kind of cool to see that, because I mean, there are so many people that come out, and especially I've seen like celebrities that go like, oh, Steve Jobs was such a visionary, and blah, blah, blah. But they don't really know. They're just kind of echoing what they might have read, you know, maybe not at ours, but, you know, just
a lot of places.
You know, a lot of places. It's just kind of, we just kind of, you know, keep going with that and regurgitate that. But the really cool thing was that, you know, there was one of the early ones. Steve Jobs is very blatant about, and he's getting cheers from the audience he's speaking to, very blatant about, like, yeah, he called it, like, we liberated hardware from HP. And we liberated hardware. We stole this, and we got a hold of this. And now Apple's like one of the most litigious IT companies out there.
Yes.
But oh my, he was so unabashed about how much they stole, be it tech, be it parts, be it technology, be it inspiration, be it actual stolen like boards to sell those first 40 or 50 machines. It's like, you know, you forget those early stories. You know, yes, yep. He's a visionary. Yes, he was ever. But at one time, he was a fairly shady 22-year-old college student.
He was
smoked
a pirate.
A lot of, yeah, whatever.
So. That was the whole deal. You want to be a pirate rather than join the Navy. That was Apple's.
Well, he was a business pirate. He's always kind of a business pirate.
Couldn't code his way out of a paper bag. Yeah. Never. I mean, not like Bill Gates, who is at least at one point a legitimate programmer.
Gates is still very smart. And Jobs was the business guy. He was the, and he did have a certain amount of charisma even before the black, you know, t-shirts.
Oh, sure.
But it was always Woz. You know, without Woz, there'd be no Apple.
On the hardware side. Condition. But Woz is like, I've never met the man, but from my understanding, from watching interviews with him, from hearing him speak, he doesn't really live in the same world that we live in.
He doesn't really care to, I don't think, for the most part.
He doesn't have to. He's certainly wealthy enough to where he can live in,
to make it work.
He can live in whatever world he wants
He's been printing his own money for a while. Like, he calls it Woz Bucks, and he'll go out and he'll try to pay for it. But the thing is, he's got such a following that people actually take that now. And I think that he's traded online where it might be as valuable as actual money.
Well,
I would like a Woz Buck.
I don't know if he is a legit billionaire, but he is certainly a multi many times over millionaire from his Apple involvement. I mean, yeah, man can do whatever he wants, and good for him.
That's the thing. Just because of who he is, I think if he had an idea, he could get funding. He could find someone that was going to believe in him. He could call up somebody and, you know, get some money somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and still a legit engineering talent. The guy's absolutely brilliant. Some of the stories on folklore.org, which is Andy Hertzfeld's site, one of the hardware designers on the original Mac, go into deep depths praising the, in detail, some of just the ridiculous engineering challenges that Woz did in putting the Apple II specifically together, and how, you know, they had to reverse engineer some of it to do some of the original Mac design, and like they couldn't believe when they got into the hardware, like, how is this even work?
Yeah. Well, the initial builds would take between 40 and 50 hours just to assemble one computer. And then it was another 20 to 30 hours of debugging to figure out what you didn't quite get right during that first 40 to 50 hour build.
Well, and Apple had color in their stuff very, very early. In 78 or 79, I remember being in a computer lab at the school I was at. You know, I was in junior high playing Breakout in color on a screen where the best you could get from anybody else was, you know, your basic green or amber monitor.
Well, and didn't the Apple IIs do didn't they do composite color with some kind of funky subpixel weird like bleed through to like fake a whole bunch of different colors that weren't actually available?
Yeah.
That sounds like a Woz-like thing.
There's some interviews with Woz on that. The thing with Apple, with them being in the lead though now, and the thing that I would watch for is my eye is open and out towards them being too precious or going kind of too far where it's too fancy. I worry that Johnny Ive, I mean, he's got great design sense and interesting ideas, but if you go too far down some of that path, you end up with, I guess maybe the best example would be, you end up with the Apple Watch Edition or whatever, the $18,000 rose edition. Gold thing that that people have too much money by, but nobody else.
Well that's not poor design. That's just stupidity, I think.
There's probably there's a marketing element to it. I'm sure they'll sell a few of them, but you know, all things end, right? And the modern Apple era will eventually pass as the previous Apple era did, because there was a time. You know, I mean, some of the listeners may remember it. You know, I was born in 1978, so I don't remember it. But there was a time in the late 70s and early 80s when Apple was doing its initial, you know, domination of the computer market, and their valuation was through the roof, and they were absolutely an unstoppable juggernaut. And that time passed a lot of because they bet on the Lisa improperly, and then they overpriced the Mac, and then canned Steve Jobs, and then brought in just a series of poor choice CEOs.
Well, that's the pendulum. I mean, Steve Jobs is there, does really well, he leaves, not so good, comes back, does really well, so he's gone again. So
during
the second coming or third coming of Jobs, the company's completely going to turn around.
Exactly. When he comes back the next time, Zombie Jobs comes back. But, I mean, the argument's there that he needed to leave that first time.
He needed
to go and do that seasoning at Next and actually become not just a, you know, an expletive spewing, like elevator firing, you know, crazy guy. He needed to actually mature and become still a jerk, but more of a leader than a jerk.
He had to go shopping for some turtlenecks. You know,
he did.
Took
he had to go buy the
turtlenecks. To settle on a shirt.
Right.
It could have gone all with plaid for a while, plaid button
and,
up.
And
no.
For a hobby, he needed to have Pixar. It's one of those things that you'd forget about kind of how much he did while he was out in the wilderness.
Didn't mean to sort of swerve this into the lionizing Steve Jobs show, but I mean, kind of to wrap this all back around again, the whole deal is that we have this great competitive landscape. Things are much more healthy now in the home market. Now that Apple is back in it and swinging, because they drive everybody else, even though they have overall a relatively insignificant portion of sales. I think in the desktop market, they're 12%, 11%. So they're past the 10% mark, but not much. In the mobile market, I don't know where they are in China and developing, but for the most part...
On the cellular phones, they make the vast majority of the profits that are made from selling phones.
They do. They don't have it's not units. They are in the minority on units by a significant number, but they drag the margin like nobody does. But they drive all the other companies in the industry trying to either be ahead of them or compete with them. And we as customers, we as the people who are buying the technology, we've got it better today than I think we ever have at any point in the past as far as the variety and quality of hardware we can buy.
Well, their price point, I think, in 87 when Jobs was trying to get out that next computer was they were saying, like, look, we've got to come in at 3,000 or under because people think that 3,000 is expensive and too expensive. And really, and that was back in late 80s dollars. That would be, think about that. That'd be closer probably like to 7,500 today.
Oh, yeah, at least.
So the fact that we can get something for, you know, like half that 20 years later.
Oh, yeah.
Check me. 30, closer to 30 years later.
Yeah, jeez.
Whoa, check that. Closer to 40. Journalist math.
Not yet.
The only odd thing, circling back to the bite of the apple thing, the only odd thing in the new iMacs is that none of them have the USB-C connector
I figured that would already be out, though, because they talked about that six
only
months ago.
Only on the
ago.
Mobile side.
Well, and it's only on the MacBook, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the only thing that has it right now.
Give them time. I'm sure they'll.
Yeah, it just struck me as odd. You'd think that they would.
Repeat on that. Yeah.
One other oddity also on the iMac side is my Apple guy pointed this out. Andrew Cunningham said that the entry level iMacs across the entire line, 21 and 27, still come with no Fusion Drive. If you get the base model. You know, the minimum cost, $9.99, whatever the bottom end cost one is, you get it with a 5400 RPM hard drive, like it's, you know, 1994 all over again.
Well, even the low-end 4K version of the 21.5 comes with a 5400 RPM regular SATA drive.
That hurts.
It's still kind of tough. I mean, you don't really have large SSDs showing up in laptops yet. I mean, that's the thing. You can't really, like, I don't even think, what is it, half a terabyte in the new Surface Book, and maybe it, yeah, I think just half a terabyte, too, in the top one MacBook Pro.
I thought you'd get a terabyte in the
You can get a terabyte in a MacBook Pro.
They do. It's a MacBook Pro. It's a little PCIe one, a little sticky, a little stick one.
Although it is odd, you'd think, you know, so you're going to 4K for the graphics, and then you stick a spinning hard drive in it. It seems like you would at least make the base thing be a Fusion drive. Mm-hmm. Seems like a better fit, but I'm guessing the deal is to hit a price point.
They
can cut that $100.
It's to hit a margin, probably more than anything else. Although I've got to believe that the marginal cost on, what did you say, they have like a 24 gig teeny tiny little thing, it can't be that huge. But maybe at the volume they expect to move, it would be too much of a margin hit. Who knows, man?
Are we still talking about computers?
Sure.
Apple still.
Why not?
And Apple.
A little bit of business thrown in there, too.
Business. Right. Some business. All right.
I've one and a half things for Try by or Fry.
Wait, let's play the thing. Hold on, I'll get it. I'll get the thing. It's over here somewhere. There it is.
In the world of technology, new things come out every day. Our judges will decide whether to try, buy, or fry.
I will confess that every time I hear that, I think he says nude things every day.
Yeah.
Woo! Well, that bumper is going to get re-recorded. I've got a new idea in mind. That's the weakest.
Peter Hughes, and he's got ideas.
Yeah. I think we're going for the snark tank approach.
You're fired.
That would make a great show.
You're fired.
So, anyways, on Try by Fry, the this one, it's iPhone only, but I think it's a cool, it's an interesting device, at least, to talk about. It's called the Ink Case, and what it is a case that you put on your iPhone 6, and...
Not Plus, apparently.
I don't know if they offer it for the Plus also or not.
I kind of like this.
Get a chance to check
tipping
that.
Tipping my hand on Try by or Fry response.
the deal is, it's a case you put on the phone. And on the back of your phone, then, it has a 4.3-inch e-ink display, which, of course, it connects over Bluetooth to the phone, so you can display stuff like boarding passes or payment cards or notifications and stuff. And, of course, the e-ink doesn't – if it's not changing, it doesn't use energy. It just – you know, it's sort of like – it's like paper that way. And so you get – you know, you get access to that kind of information. It doesn't kill your battery and adds a whole nother screen to your phone for around $100. So yeah, if they don't have it for the 6 Plus, that would be a real mistake on their part.
Lame.
I would think.
They don't seem to have it for the 6 Plus. They have it for the 6 and the 6S. But...
Okay, well then that is lame. I'm surprised that somebody has, I think there is one of the phones, now I'm forgetting which one it was. There was one that had a like e-ink back panel as a part of the actual built into the phone.
Was that HTC? Didn't HTC do that?
I thought it was one of those that was sort of their that it was like they had their one product and that had the Yada phone or one of those had it. It was a more obscure one as opposed to one of the biggies. So that one, I guess, unless you've got an iPhone 6 and a real interest in e-ink, I think that one goes fry. This one is more of a software update that the Tesla software update came out. And so now the articles with the semi-autonomous driving of the Tesla Model S is out. And so the articles about using it have started to kind of come up.
Yeah, they had a big demo in New York today.
And so the thing is, it's supposed to, like, they call it autopilot. And they have some new, you know, where it supposedly, where it, it's the kind of adaptive cruise control that it had before, and except enhanced. And then auto steer is a beta, which keeps your car in the current lane and engages traffic aware cruise control, it says. The thing that it, the all the articles have people sitting in the car with their hands off the steering wheel while the auto steer handles it. Tesla requires that you're supposed to have your hands on the steering wheel all the time. But I have a feeling that's one that's just a liability thing that they say that.
It is.
And
yeah.
they also have the auto lane change where if you put on the turn indicator, then it will switch lanes when the conditions are safe to do it. And then the last thing is if you if you tell it where you're wanting to go, you give it your destination at the beginning of your trip, and when you get to the place that you're trying to be, I guess, oh, here it says when you're driving low speeds around cities, a P will appear on the instrument panel when the Tesla detects a parking spot, and if you activate it, then auto park will begin to park the car by itself, controlling the steering wheel and vehicle speed.
Neat.
I would like to try it. I want to see people using it because I think that's going to help get it out to more vehicles besides Teslas.
Go to your Tesla showroom in San Antonio, and I'm sure they'll be happy to give you a demo.
Just got an update from Dwight Silverman. Apparently, none of the suggestions worked except for Lee's about calling into voicemail.
Whee! that's the old school method.
The old-fashioned way.
Yeah. I like this Tesla thing. I mean, I think it's neat. It's a neat set of features. It's expensive. I mean, under the try, buy, or fry heading, you know, a fully kitted out P90D is now the top model, the 90 kilowatt hour battery with a dual motor or whatever. I mean, it's still run you $130,000 or so.
I just had the greatest idea. What I need to do is find a way to buy a Tesla, state of the art, and then decorate it with Randy Kilowatt and drive it in the art car parade.
There you go. And it's like almost like a business. No, it's a tax deduction if you do that, right?
I wonder if I could sell Reliant on the idea. Mm-hmm. I wonder if Randy Kilowatt.
Maybe. I thought you were going to say, I wonder if I could sell a kidney to be able to buy a car. It's like, no, you'd probably have to sell like five or six kidneys.
Model X. So then you can drive down the street slowly with those gull-wing doors up and open.
But they're not called gull-wing doors. They're called falcon-wing doors.
Because gulls are lame.
That's right. Falcon-wing.
Well.
I mean, you know, I think the Tesla thing's a buy if you can swing it.
Yeah, well, but let's see. The entire KPFT fund drive that we just came through,
mm-hmm.
I think raised enough to buy a couple of kitted out. We could just find a way to get station management to give us all the money they just raised. We could.
Your tax deductible donations go to buy the hosts of Technology Bytes.
To buy two hosts of Technology Bytes.
No, we share. We have a rotation system. It's like a timeshare. Timeshare on our Teslas.
Yeah, I'll pick you up on the way into town each week.
I'll take it Monday, Wednesday.
Oh.
No.
It's good. It was a good car. I enjoyed driving it. I wouldn't mind having one with all the auto-driving features. It sounds neat.
Well, the fascinating thing will be, I mean, they've learned a lot doing the expensive cars, and I think in another couple years, when they're going to come out with their sort of mainstream one that normal people could consider affording. I mean, it's not going to be $20,000, but I think that the target price is around $35,000, and they will certainly have learned a lot from what they've done with the other vehicles.
Yeah, the idea is to have it at about $30,000 and to have it about 200 miles of range. I mean, it's supposed to be, they're targeting sort of that entry-level luxury, so BMW 3 Series kind of price. Like a stick horse 325 entry level, that's kind of where they're going with the price. And if they follow their current patterns, then it'll be approximately double that once you tack on all of the options that you really want and need in order to make the car desirable. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. I don't know if I can swing the...
I'm looking forward to not being able to afford that either.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of putting it. Looking forward
well,
to having...
Well, at least they also have... There's the looming competition from Apple with the Apple Car thing. Whatever
possibly.
That's going to be.
Possibly. Although, did you hear... Now is probably a good time than any. Did you hear Elon Musk's comment about Apple versus Tesla? He had a... Musk had an amazing quote. Hold on, I'm gonna dig it up so I don't misquote it.
A burst of honesty that then he walked back, I think. It was that Apple's hired the people who Tesla's let go or has gotten...
Wait, hold on.
They're hiring our Schaefer.
He says...
one of those.
He tossed some major shade. They have hired people we fired, Musk said. We always jokingly call Apple the Tesla graveyard. If you don't make it at Tesla, you go work at Apple. I'm not kidding. So said Elon Musk in an interview with a German newspaper, Handelsblatt.
Yeah, and then within a couple of days, he was being a lot nicer about Apple and a lot more, I don't know how you put it. He was being a lot more even-handed in his discussions of other
That's because
companies.
That kind of crossed the line. You know, these major companies, even if they're bitter competitors, they always maintain sort of, you know, a little bit of public distance and cordialness. And that was a little over the line. That was like an old school Apple versus Microsoft kind of comment.
Well, what I heard is all of Musk's Apple equipment tried to kill him.
His phone caught on fire on the nightstand in the middle of the night.
His watch started getting tighter and tighter.
Well, you want to bust into some science, Pete?
Do we want to hit 88 miles an hour?
All right, let's see. I think I can make that happen. Somehow, find my mouse cursor. There we go.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious science.
Which, I'll do a bit of mini Barrett time. You know, the 21st of October, 2015, is Back to the Future Day. When Marty came to the hoverboard future that we're not living in.
We're going to celebrate by watching Jaws 27.
Roll around on the sidewalk or whatever. So on science news, got two picture stories. One that came out while we were fun driving, but I think it's worth bringing up. NASA has put their archives up on the internet. 13,000 scans of images from NASA's archives taken across all manned Apollo missions from 1961 to 1972. Were given to the founder of the Project Apollo Archive, a man named Kip Teague. He told Newsbeat, quote, serious budget cuts mean the organization doesn't have the resources to publish them, so he's done it for them. Astronaut selfies and all. So you can go, I guess, at the Project Apollo Archive. It's on Flickr. If you go to Flickr and search for Apollo, you can see all these pictures. There's also been some people have retouched some of them where they have adjusted the colors and that. And the pictures are just they're as amazing as you would think. Or another way, now the conspiracy-minded approach to this. After all these decades, NASA has finally finished faking the last of the photos.
You know,
so
it's,
they can release them to the public.
That's funny, too, because, I mean, a lot of these pictures already have been available, not anywhere near this total amount, but they've been available on the Apollo Image Archive and a site NASA maintains called the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, which has had contributions by Kip Teague in the past, too. What you just said comes up a lot when people encounter some of these images on the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, especially because they've got a lot of the – they've got – tons of images from the original missions that have been color corrected, and they're put up sort of in a timeline along with the missions and the dialogue and everything. But the comment about how like the quality on them is absolutely amazing. Everybody says that, and you got to remember, especially the images that were taken on the surface. I mean, these are photographs that were taken on 70 millimeter film with, you know, $30,000 Hasselblad cameras. This is like...
And a backstage in Hollywood somewhere.
Yeah, on a backstage in Hollywood. And carefully controlled environmental conditions in Hollywood. But I mean, yeah, This is high quality film with high quality equipment, and Kubrick, it's no wonder
Kubrick
it looks
was
good.
Well known for doing you know, really nice shots.
You guys,
I wish you'd gotten credit though.
I was trying to make a serious point that like that you should not be surprised at the quality of these images. This is 70mm film. It looks that good because that's how good it is.
Well, and we've talked about it before that, you know, the sad thing is that they used to have the tapes, and I think there's some of it maybe still around, but I don't think it's ever been, like, really digitized and done where it'd be available for everybody going forward. The stuff that we all saw on TV was a pale shadow of what was sent down from the moon, from the, like, you know, the original landing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they got
had
better.
Much higher images that they could have. You know, that could have been done, but by that time NASA had moved on and the tapes were sitting there in a, you know, whatever warehouse.
Yes, and that's correct. And then they were recorded over. I mean, and they got better. The footage from Apollo 15 and 16 and 17, the video footage was very good. But for 11, I mean, literally, it was broadcast in a non-standard format, and the images that every, like, you know, if you were alive in 1969 and you were up watching, you know, the live footage of the Apollo landing, what you saw on your TV was a video relay from a video camera in Australia that was pointed at a monitor that was at a different frame rate, or there was a different refresh rate that was displaying the native image. So it was like a two generations removed camera pointed at a TV screen version of the film, because that was the only
but
way
the resolution
to do
on
it.
TVs were so bad. Most people really couldn't.
Most people couldn't. It was all that, yeah. Well, but I mean, even then, I'm sure it looked like bad. But the point is, the original, the camera that was on the LM, the landing camera they used, it wasn't that bad. It just that was the only way to display it. And then it was recorded to, like, you know, like Pete said, it was recorded on whatever reel-to-reel format they had, and then, you know, stuck in a warehouse somewhere, and eventually somebody accidentally recorded over it, put, you know, Masterpiece Theater on it or something.
on other stuff recorded, there's a program called the NASA Outer Planet Atmospheres Legacy Program, which aims to observe the outer planets every year using the Hubble. And they've released their first ultra HD maps and images. The first one they've released is Jupiter. And so it's like 4K, you know, that many pixels images. And it does show motion, and it allows them to compare the, you know, to compare things like, you know, the giant red dot storm on Jupiter has been changing. And when you can see it at 4K, obviously there's a lot more detail that's available to see what it looks like. There's a link to the article, and has a link to some of the pictures, but it also has, so they have, you know, moving video of Jupiter in 4K Ultra HD. Which is pretty, it's pretty awesome. I mean, it's one of those where it's just that kind of stuff. Seeing it that clearly is just pretty amazing and mind blowing. So it's certainly worth a look for the ability to go look at that from your home and have, you know, pictures of Jupiter from something as high end as the Hubble playing on your computer. That's one
that's
of
a big
those.
Deal.
Just don't watch it from the 5K Apple.
That's right.
You may be disappointed.
You'll see the wires Apple. Holding it up.
So,
all right.
And then I guess finally that there's an article. You
hey, we're out of time, Pete.
Yeah.
Says the best way to get to Mars is to have a base on the moon.
Pete,
so you can go read that if you're interested.
You can go to the moon.
Go to the moon.
Before that, though, come out to
the first
Saturday.
Go to the geek party. At,
the geek party.
Twenty years.
20 years of Technology Bites. After the party's over, we have to stop talking about the age of the show until the next milestone.
What's
so,
that, 25?
25.
Or 21, the show will be able to drink.
That's true enough. Let's get our drink on. Let's do some underage drinking this Saturday.
I don't think you can say that on here.
As a show.
As a show. All right, well, we hope you'll come out and join us for our 20th anniversary extrava bonanza. At Cones, the information is up at geekradio.com.
Must be 21 to drink. Tell your friends.
He has to be 21 to drink. All right, so tell your friends. Everybody
tell your friends.
Be,
I was
just calculating, and I just realized I'm of age. Awesome.
Barely.
I know, it just doesn't show.
Barely there.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. This has been Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's?
Brewhouse.
Yes, he is. Not Jay Lee. No,
not this time.
KPFT is pleased to announce Electro Love Fest, a musical fundraising event at Last Concert Cafe on Saturday, November 7th. We thank our sponsors, Funky Bats, the experts on all things funky, Uncle Hank and Miss Linda, Bill Roberts with Hilton Hospitality and lovely wife Amada, the Big Easy Social and Pleasure Club owner Tom McClendon. We have need for additional sponsors for the event and excellent sponsored packages to offer businesses, individuals, couples, artists, professionals, or anyone wanting to support KPFT and enjoy the event as our guests. We hope you'll join these local businesses and individuals in supporting KPFT into the 46th year of operation as your community radio station. To become a sponsor, call Robin Lewis at 713-526-4000, extension 315. Please call and help KPFT live into the future.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial.